This is November 10th. This is Lecture 21, Political Settlement or Negotiated Settlement of the Vietnam War. Specifically, or chiefly, the Paris Talks. The central question here is whether there ever was a possibility of reaching true political settlement. One would think that after all this time, 25 years, there would be something like a historical consensus or agreement on the matter. But there is not. You have a handout that sets forth the war's contenders and their objectives. At the bottom is the question on a settlement. Study it at your leisure. It would be one of the questions on the final exam. The second handout is a position paper turned out by the U.S. government in 1973. That's useful mostly for what people in Washington and in Saigon were thinking about a political settlement at the time. Mostly in Washington. People in Saigon, I can recall, having been there, didn't think much about what was going on in Paris at all. We had our own kettle of fish to fry, and we wished them lots of luck, but we didn't have much faith in them. In the third handout, this chronology of negotiations, I'm not sure where that came from. It's not all that reliable or trustworthy, this chronology. What is here is okay, but much is absent. For one thing, it only covers the 1972 period onward. There was a good deal of activity in the direction of some kind of a political settlement before then. At the UN, the Italians, French, De Gaulle, others made various efforts to try to settle the Vietnam War. Didn't come to anything, but it really belongs in a chronology. The best book on this subject is Alan Goodman's book called The Lost Peace. Goodman is a dean at Georgetown University in Washington now. Lost Peace, Stanford Press, 1978, I think. All right, let me begin by making a few general remarks about the subject of diplomatic negotiations of contending issues. Point one, all issues in theory can be negotiated, providing there is a willingness on both sides to compromise. As far as substance is concerned, all is negotiable. That's a principle in international diplomatic intercourse. More correctly, I guess you would say it's an article of faith. What I'm saying here is really applicable to all kinds of international settlements of problems, including the Mideast today. So, in theory, all issues can be negotiated. Point two, some issues are more easily negotiated than others. The three most difficult of these, and also the three most common, are one, the zero-sum game, two, issues which are not divisible, and three, issues which are culturally rooted. The zero-sum game issues, what one side gains, the other loses. It's like poker. At the end of the night, the winnings by the winners totaled up equal the losers by the losings by the losers. The approach in a zero-sum game in international relations is to try to drown the issue in a larger context, that is, convert it to a non-zero-sum game. Many examples of these. French-German antipathies after three wars was very great in Britain and in Europe. It was a great block impediment to the common market. But the principle of this is you drown this antipathy in a a larger interest, make it an interest both to the Germans and the French, who don't like each other, to join the common market because there's something to be gained by it. And gradually this bad feeling tends to evaporate. I wrote a book on how this could be done in Vietnam, called War, Peace, and the Viet Cong. I don't think anybody ever read it. It was how it could be drowned in a larger issue, the Federation of Indochina. But the cop-out in the book was that there are some things that men cannot do for themselves, but time can do it for them. And that this was what I felt would be the ultimate solution to the Vietnam War. Right, second type of issues, they're very difficult, are those which are not divisible, are not compromisable by their inherent nature, as unification and no unification in Vietnam was the case. The Northerners wanted unification, the Southerners didn't. Third, our most difficult issue are those that are culturally rooted, usually over the centuries. Some of these are very famous: the Arab Jew, the Greek Turkish, Hindu Muslim, English Irish, Cambodian Vietnamese. They're ancient antipathies, and they defy the best efforts of outsiders who come in and say, we will try to ameliorate this, we'll try to reach some kind of a arrangement that will be acceptable to you, and when it's turned down by one side or the other, or usually both sides, then you resort to, this is what much of the Foreign Service is involved in doing this sort of thing as a third party, saying, this is really madness the way you two people are treating each other. It's not in the interest of either of you. And the standard answer from on both sides is, but you say that because you're not one of us. If you're one of us, you would understand. But you're not, and you can't, and so you don't, and that's it. They say it's the kind of curse of the Foreign Service. This is what Clinton got caught in the middle of and recently in Washington. All right. The great overriding issue in the Vietnam War then, and still an issue academically, is or was it possible to settle by negotiations? One end of the argument said that it was, but it was being sabotaged, effort to achieve a negotiated settlement. Anti-war crowd in the United States took this position, so did in the opposite side, so did the South Vietnamese. Anti-war crowd generally said it was Washington that was sabotaging it. South Vietnamese said it was the North Vietnamese that was sabotaging it. But at any rate, it was conceded that there could be a settlement if everybody got responsible and willing to compromise. The other end of this argument was, it said that a negotiated settlement was not really ever possible by virtue of the issues involved. If you look at the handout, you see the objectives and the contenders, and you can ask yourself how, theoretically, if at all, a settlement involving compromise and good give and take could have been achieved that would be satisfactory to all of these participants. North Vietnamese wanted unification of North and South Vietnam under their banner. The National Liberation Front of the Viet Cong wanted a monopoly of political power in South Vietnam. We are the sole legitimate representatives of the South Vietnamese people and for their associated elements. The Allied forces wanted prevention of unification of Vietnam by force. They wanted maintenance of a strategic equilibrium in Southeast Asia and in the Pacific in general. Cambodians and the Lao wanted the foreign communists out of their country, and they wanted some kind of a political reconstruction with the dissident elements in their societies. The Chinese were the most striking. They began early in the war by wanting the U.S. out of Southeast Asia entirely. China was a regional power, and in the process of the passage of time during the war, it became a global power, and its interests changed 180 degrees. It no longer wanted the U.S. out of Southeast Asia. It wanted it in there as a balance to defend off the Russians, balance of power, struggle for power. USSR sought, I think, mostly to gain support in the worldwide question, who is going to run communism, communist system, common term. They also wanted to deprecate and nullify U.S. prowess, deprecate its ability to control events, influence them. Most of all, I think the Russians really never wanted to get trapped in Vietnam. That's what they tell us today, at least. NATO allies wanted an end to the war without weakening the alliance. So the question within this collection of objectives among allies and contenders, could a political settlement have been reached? Was it really ever in the cards? Hanoi's attitude, which I think is key in this, toward negotiations was a straight, unbroken line from the start of the war. Negotiations with the enemy was regarded as a technique, not a method of conflict resolution. These negotiations are to be viewed solely on a kind of tactical, strategic continuum. It could be used to advance the cause. It could be used to disrupt the enemy's internal scene. It could be used to mislead enemy leaders. It could be used to divide the elements in the enemy camp. Hanoi negotiators never regarded negotiations as a process of compromise, of give and take dealing, nor was there ever any sense of obligation to reach an agreement and stick to it once it was reached. The Paris Agreement, actually a ceasefire arrangement and not a political settlement, bound the Vietnamese communists to conditions which, if they had been fulfilled, would have destroyed the party in the South and ruined all chance of unification. But commitment to such agreement was never the intention, as the rather candid writings of post-war officials admit or say, much to the embarrassment of some of their foreign apologists. In Paris, the course of the talks essentially came down to the Americans and the South Vietnamese searching for some means of halting the fighting, and the communists attempting to destroy, or at least to weaken, the organizational and political structure of the South Vietnamese government. The DRV negotiators worked for, and they thought in terms of Dao Chan, struggle. They struggled in the name of unilateral disarmament for South Vietnam and U.S.-managed disestablishment of the GVN. They said to the Americans, our price for a settlement is you get out, you Americans get out, and you take your weapons with you, and your arms, all your machines, not only yours, but the stuff that you have given to the South Vietnamese. Take it all out. Well, everything that the South Vietnamese had in the way of military hardware came from the Americans. So you took all of this out, that would mean that they would be unilaterally disarmed. How they could say this month after month with a straight face and not have the world sort of laugh at them in terms of the objectives which they're trying to serve they obfuscated it in what I was talking about yesterday and last time about channeling linguistic thought. Yeah, it's perfectly logical for them to say this, to make this as a position, but you can't believe they really expected us to. Anyway, that's what hung it up for years. The specific issues discussed were ceasefire, ultimate disposition of the contending forces, the Americans and the North Vietnamese in the South, and the essential return of POWs was a big issue for the Americans particularly. Central non-military issue was who was to govern in South Vietnam and the manner by which this governing force would be brought into power. In substantive terms, the communists really offered little and they asked for much. Mostly what they demanded was American capitulation. The important point is not this extreme position, though. After all, the demand for capitulation could be intended as an initial bargaining position. But it sought to force the U.S. to serve their goal of unification. Had the object been to negotiate the Americans out of Vietnam only, this could have been accomplished in a few weeks in the spring of 1968. The objective of the North Vietnamese was unification, and the purpose of the Paris talks was to contribute to this. That was the beginning and the end of their interest in it. Well, increased pressures, chiefly internal in Hanoi, doctrinal infighting at the Politburo level, and the renewed and then intensified on-again, off-again U.S. bombing campaign combined in late 1972 to force a Politburo doctrinal balance, political balance in the so-called hawks and doves. They weren't really doves. This was the way we regarded them. There were some hawks, some doves in the Politburo, and the balance shifted over to the doves. For those who argued that they should permit their negotiators in Paris to separate military policy, that is the war, from political aspects in the settlement, and drop the requirement that the political future of South Vietnam be mapped out before a ceasefire be effected. Once that divorce had been established, the rest of the negotiations followed naturally. So the Vietnam Agreement was announced on January 24, 1973. Its chief military provisions were, one, an internationally supervised ceasefire in North and South Vietnam beginning January 28, 1973. Two, release in 60 days of all American servicemen and civilians captured and held throughout Indochina. Three, full accounting of the troops missing in action, the American missing in action, Allied missing. Four, departure of all American and Allied forces and military personnel from South Vietnam within 60 days. Five, a ban on infiltration of Pavan troops and war supplies into South Vietnam, that is from the north into the south. And six, the right of the GVN to unlimited military replacement of aid. Seven, respect for the demilitarized zone that separated North and South Vietnam. Eight, reunification of Vietnam by peaceful means through negotiations between North and South Vietnam without coercion and without annexation. Nine, reduction and demobilization of communist and government forces, North Vietnam government forces in the South. Ten, a ban on the use of Laos and Cambodia base areas, and withdrawal of all foreign troops from Laos and Cambodia. The chief political provisions were contained in a joint statement issued by the U.S. and the DRV. These were, one, that the South Vietnamese people have a right to self-determination, two, that the GVN continues in existence and is so recognized by the U.S. with its constitutional structures and its leadership intact and unchanged. Three, formation in South Vietnam of a non-governmental National Council of Reconciliation and Concord. National Council of National Reconciliation Concord. That was a non-governmental structure that would be operating through the principle of unanimity. Anything they did had to be uniformly agreed by all parties. they would organize elections and form the parties to promote the conciliation and the implementation of the agreement. The National Council, as it was called, was really meant, it was not a new government or even a non-governmental structure. It was an instrument for implementing the Geneva Agreements. The protocols also reaffirmed the 1954 and the 1962 Geneva Agreements on Cambodia and Laos, respect for the independence, sovereignty, unity, territorial integrity of Cambodia and Laos. They banned infiltration and the introduction of war supplies into either of these countries, forbade the use of territory for either as base areas, and called for the elimination of all foreign troops from Laos and Cambodia. And the protocol stipulated U.S. participation in post-war reconstruction efforts throughout Indochina, as well as the establishment of a new relationship between America, the U.S., and North Vietnam. Well, this was on the $2.6 billion post-war reparations business, of which I'll have more to say later. An international commission of control and supervision, called the ICCS, was established. And 1,160 international supervisory personnel came in to supervise the various military provisions of the agreement. A joint military commission called the JMC was established at Tan Sanut in Saigon, in which there was a four-power commission, the North Vietnamese, South Vietnamese, the PRG, or the Viet Cong, and the U.S. Eventually, it became a two-power commission, the GVN and the South Viet Cong. ICC, which is what it was called during the Viet Minh era, ICCS, was made up of the originally the Canadians and the Poles and the Indians. This was a pro-American, or if you will, or anti-American, socialist, non-socialist, and a neutral. And these changed over the time. The Canadians got tired of it and quit. The Iranians came in and took their place. They had camps all over the country, and interesting place to visit. I'm not sure how much they ever did. This largely pro forma endorsement of the ceasefire was the framework on which the South Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, or the PRG, their instrument, were to negotiate on sharing political power in the South. It could have come to more than it did, because I feel that the North Vietnamese were losing control of the southern apparatus. They never really had that much control. And I think if Southerners and the Americans had played the game more carefully, that was the thrust of the book I wrote, they could have divided the North Vietnamese from the Southerners, and you could have had the so-called third force develop, which would be anti-GVN, but it would also be anti-North Vietnamese, DRV. But in Hanoi, the goal of unification had not been abandoned. It was clear from the start of the ceasefire that North Vietnamese did not intend to leave the South alone. This is a point Henry Kissinger keeps making. Had the Paris Agreement been scrupulously observed, the DRV would have had no legal means to support its 150,000 troops. They would have withered in the South, and the agreement made with Laos and Cambodia about crossing the DMZ, if that had been sacrosanct, there would have been no way for them to bring in supplies and forces except through a couple of checkpoints that were monitored by the ICC. But that did not happen. The flow through the Ho Chi Minh Trail continued, the rowboat armada, as they called it, kept coming down the coast with supplies, and new troops kept coming in, and the old troops were rotated home. I don't know that we could have expected them to do anything but that. That's the argument that's still going on. Was peace possible? Did they work out something that could have been the answer? Or was it never in the cards? I don't think there's a lot of dogmatic answers to that on both sides. I don't think anybody can say dogmatically that anyway, as we heard last week, General Joplin and company simply decided after the Paris agreements they would begin one last hurrah, with one last effort, the Ho Chi Minh campaign, it was called. It wound up sending every division they had in the north-south, and they won the war. One of the ironies is they still claim that the Paris agreements are in place because we'd promised to bind up the wounds of war, when we'd made it very clear that this binding up the wounds of war meant that they would not resume the war. And it's rather technicality, but the State Department each year publishes a treaties in effect, those treaties that we have which are still in effect. And about 10 years ago, they dropped the Paris Agreement, saying it's no longer in effect. It's been so badly abrogated that it's no longer reasonable, meaningful. All right, a little about the meaning of these efforts to settle the war. I won't go into the details of what the Italians had proposed, what the Secretary General of the UN proposed at various times. Indians got into it in a very big way. Indians used to be the mother-in-law of the world on this sort of thing, second only to the Swedes, I guess you'd say. I don't say that around my wife, who's Swedish. Anyway, agreements to end wars can exist at various levels of complexity, and they represent differing degrees of ambition. There can be a temporary ceasefire agreement, a more or less permanent armistice agreement, a full-scale treaty, and therefore, given this wide spectrum of possible arrangements, it's very dangerous to generalize. However, in examining the Indochina experience over the years, to effect an end to hostilities, the subsequent outcomes, certain conclusions suggest themselves. There are about four of these. First, the environment of the agreement automatically determines the conditions of its enforcement, dictates the kind of verification or enforcement problem to be expected, and foreshadows the probability of success or failure of the agreement. By way of illustration, World War I armistice agreement was simple to define and easily verify. Two contending armies faced each other along hundreds of miles of no man's land. Violations were immediately known, and in most cases, the instigator identifiable. In Korea, there was a main line of resistance, MLR, more or less at the 38th parallel, separating the two sides. But the MLR was more ambiguous, and consequently monitoring the ceasefire agreement was made more uncertain. In Vietnam, there was no territorial, as examples. The front was everywhere, and it was nowhere. Such is the character of insurgency or guerrilla warfare. The only firm demarcation line was the DMZ between North and South Vietnam, and it rather never really figured importantly in the environment of the Indochina agreements. North Vietnamese did not send troops and arms across the DMZ. They sent it around through Laos or by sea. in Vietnam, both sides spoke of what was called an in-place ceasefire, which would separate the GVN elements from the Viet Cong-controlled GVN villages and the Viet Cong-controlled villages, according to the so-called leopard spot principle. But in fact, no such separation was possible. What developed, as I said last time, was the War of Flags, in which contending forces would come in and tear down the other's flag, and the next day the other side would do the same thing. So the dividing line did exist, but it changed daily in accordance with the fortunes of war of the local combatants. And there can be other elements in the agreement environment. One is ethnic identity. That was the case in Malaya, in the Malayan emergency, where the guerrillas were all Chinese, and they all came out of Chinese villages and were supported by the Chinese people. So the separating those was an easier case, of course, for the British than it was the case in Vietnam. The same thing is true in Burma. Another factor, which is sanctuary, talked about that before, which in effect is an alliance with a foreign party. The Greek Civil War, for example, was forced to an end after Tito closed the border to the Greek insurgents. Thus, an agreement may require at least tacit acceptance by outside powers. From this, we must conclude that the peace armistice agreements can be verified and enforced, while others, because of their nature, that is, the environment in which they exist, cannot be supervised. The latter was consistently proved to be the case in Indochina, both with the Viet Minh and the Vietnam War, and with the Laos Agreement. Second conclusion is that an agreement terminating or suspending a war almost always is approached by both sides in terms of potential opportunity to consider pursuit of the unfulfilled wartime objectives that are denied by the battlefield. This is sort of a case of von Clausewitz turned around, a case of war by other means. The only exception here really is unconditional surrender, in which one side agrees to capitulate, but that's not an agreement in the terms that we use here. Wars begin in the first place because each side seeks to enforce its will and to achieve its goal. Agreements are reached when neither side can achieve its goal through warfare and becomes interested in exploring other means of accomplishing the same end. The terms of the agreement, as well as subsequent supervisory mechanism, are viewed from the start in light of eventually achieving the wartime objective. Usually this is a pessimistic hope, at least for one side. It's a forlorn hope that has led to the oft-observed dictum that you cannot win at the conference table what you have lost on the battlefield, or what you failed to win on the battlefield. In any case, both the agreement and the supervision process represents a function of continued ambitions on both sides. If each side sees it's in its interest are being served, there will be adherence and the agreement will prevail. This is not uncommon for short periods. There have been numerous ceasefire agreements in the Mideast, for example, some that worked quite well for brief periods, but none that has lasted. And they're more or less back to square one today. But that experience is more or less universal. It's inherent in the contention itself. Most wars are zero-sum games, and any agreement or condition developing during an agreement which greatly serves one side automatically will be seen by the other as against its interest, hence the impulse to abrogate the agreement. For the last 500 years has been the history of most peace treaties. With respect to Vietnam, the objective of Ho Chi Minh and DRV from the start was control of all of Vietnam, if not all of Indochina. In the Viet Minh War, they were able to oust the French, a major bloc to this objective, but fell short of their goal when they settled for partition of Vietnam. Actually, this was a case of having lost at the conference table, but you had won on the battlefield. The cause of unification was, in fact, the trade. North Vietnamese leaders came to believe later by their two erstwhile allies, the Chinese and the Russians. They persuaded Ho Chi Minh to settle for less than total victory in the name of proletarian solidarity. They had their own fish to fry. The Russians were trying to scuttle EDC, the European Defense Community, and thought this would help. Chinese were pushing the spirit of Bandung co-optation through Asia, and they thought that would help, and that's why they leaned on the North Vietnamese. I don't think Ho was ever fooled by any of this, but he didn't really have much choice. What it did, of course, was permanently prejudice North Vietnamese leadership against any kind of negotiated agreement. It heavily conditioned their attitude and their behavior at subsequent peace conferences. In the case of once burned, twice shy. Without belittling this too much, in Vietnam, Hanoi's objection from the start was unification under its banner. That criterion was the sole test that it put to any proposal for negotiation or political settlement. At Paris talks and elsewhere, always the question was asked, will this move us closer to, or at least the direction of, unification? If so, Hanoi was interested. If not, it was not. Obviously, a South Vietnam that remained independent, or even one that shared power with a southern apparat, was not unification. Hence, for Saigon, and actually for the southerners, there was nothing to negotiate, because what Hanoi wanted was elimination of the GVN and amalgamation of the two societies, which they finally got. Under some issues under negotiation are given to compromise because they are divisible. Political power, which the Viet Cong were willing to share, is an example of that. But unification is not. It's not divisible. Like virginity, it says here. Thus, from Hanoi's standpoint, there was nothing to negotiate except perhaps how it was to be brought about. Now, North Vietnam should have been seen as extraordinarily intransigent, particularly since it made no effort to hide the fact that its sole objective was unification and its simple single interest in negotiations was to bring this about. The theme appeared in every speech the Ho Chi Minh ever made. It was reiterated constantly in the press accounts of negotiations. But somehow, this went largely unperceived in the world outside. Partly for the reasons I gave last week on communication of ideas. There were then, and in fact there are still today, reasonably well-informed persons who believe that the Vietnamese communists throughout wanted and actively sought a negotiated settlement and had willingness to compromise. It was the U.S. and the GVN that kept the war going. We termed these the Paris Peace Talks. Hanoi and their press termed them the Paris Talks, Noi Chun, to talk. We went to Paris thinking peace. The DRV went there thinking unification. When you ask them about the Paris Talks, the Paris Peace, they say, no, these are talks. What we're doing, we're just talking. That may seem like a semantic difference, but it wasn't to them. They were there to discuss the Vietnam War. They were not there to discuss peace. Well, what was signed in Paris then was not a peace treaty or a negotiated settlement. It was only a ceasefire arrangement, and a poor one at that. For it left the enemy's army on the spot in the south and called for an unworkable supervisory mechanism that rested on a power-sharing arrangement among the contending forces and monitored by reluctant outsiders who had been dragooned in for the purpose. Well, we must conclude that Hanoi's regard for agreements it has signed over the years were narrowly utilitarian. They did then, and I would say they still do today, enter into and adhere to any agreement when it perceives it to be in its national interest, feels no legal consideration or moral structures, is free to abrogate it as an agreement at any time. We're seeing something of a mass exodus of foreign venture people in Hanoi today, who single complaint is, we came here with money to invest in industry and so on. We had a legal agreement with the North Vietnamese or the Vietnamese government, and now they have reneged on it. They've nationalized some of these industries. They've broken their word, and we're getting out. Most of the car manufacturers are getting out. Most of the big American corporations are getting out. They see this as, simple perfidy, I guess. The underlying principle of this, I can't go into the legal thinking of the Vietnamese that far, but this is true in Confucian societies in general. We Westerners and legal-oriented or legal-advised people believe that you make an agreement and you get somebody to sign the agreement. And once that's happened, then the deal is done. This is not the view of the Confucians in general, although I think the Japanese and the South Koreans understand that there's this different system, and they are now play the game our way. In the very early years of Americans or foreigners, all foreigners, Westerners, going to Asia and meeting with the king or his officials and said, we have a treaty here we would like you to sign, and they would hand it to him and he would sign it and hand it back. And afterwards they say, we got it. He signed it. And then something would happen and the advisor would say, well, no, things have changed, so this is no longer applicable. Now, in the Confucian culture, it was much more of a serious act to put your chop, your rubber stamp on a document. You see them on photographs, you see them on paintings that are owned by previous owners. They were very careful what they put their chop on, but signing a piece of paper meant nothing. We were just the opposite. We put a rubber stamp on almost anything. Didn't hold us down legally, but we were more careful on what we... I can remember when we negotiated with the South Vietnamese on what was called the... what was the first of the pacification programs. Had this team of lawyers come out from the Pentagon, and they negotiated what they wanted the GVN to do in the villages in the way of social welfare and what we were willing to do to pay for this, and well drilling and school building and so on. And we wanted certain things from them, certain assurances and so on. So I was on this committee that went on for weeks and weeks. And finally, at the end of this time, we came up with this document, gave it to the Vietnamese, South Vietnamese. They signed it very quickly, gave it back to us, and they walked out. And these lawyers have sent us on, we got them. We got them. They signed. I said, wait, let me tell you a little about the culture here. This does not necessarily mean that you have got them. Because an overriding principle of people of integrity here and so on is that changing circumstances require changing responses. And I predict that you're going to hear this from now on. And what it says is that you agree to do something unless the conditions change. And then you don't have to do it. In the U.S., it's just the opposite. You know, you sign the agreement and you go bankrupt if you have to, but you've got to stick to it because the courts will force you to. So sure enough, about the next week, there was a couple of decisions on the voting process in the village, first of the Sunrise, Operation Sunrise villages. And the Americans went in and complained to this official, and he said, well, changing circumstances require changing responses. And it wasn't this way last Friday. That was then, and this is now. I don't mean to overstress this, but this much of this thinking was I mean, the North Vietnamese were not all as villainous, maybe, as I've made them out to be, because their thinking was that they're honorable people of great integrity and they will agree to things, but if things change, then we don't agree to them. And that, the nice thing in Vietnam is you can do the same things as Vietnamese. They say, you agreed to do that. I said, yeah, I did agree to it, but changing circumstances require changing responses. Oh, well, I don't like that, but I guess it's okay. All right, third conclusion I've come to is that an agreement can never exceed its own substance, and to the extent that it is flawed, to that extent there will be failure in implementation. Indochina has been particularly cursed by flawed peace agreements. All three of the major ones here, the Viet Minh, the Vietnam, and the Lao agreements, were actually classic examples of a flawed agreement. The worst, probably, was the 1954 Geneva Agreement, in which really a gross act of international irresponsibility, the French, after 100 years of colonialism, simply walked away, unconcerned about any kind of a tutelage period for the transfer of sovereignty. The Brits did not do this in India or Burma. Indonesians didn't do it in Indonesia, but the French did. The Laos Agreement was flawed because it presumed that the DRV would close the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which would have meant really shooting yourself in the foot, in both feet probably. And that was the way you got most of your supplies to the south. So the idea was the Laos Agreement would shut off the Ho Chi Minh Trail. It didn't, but I don't know whether the people that wrote these really